Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Peter Cies, a Czech-born American illustrator, artist, and author of many children's books. An exhibition of his work, titled The Picture Book Odysseys of Peter Cies, is at the Eric Carl Museum of Picture Book Art in Amherst until October 27th. Peter, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Nice to be with you.
I find myself getting lost in your artwork. And one of the things, and you've written about in this catalog, as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of your work is about searching and dreaming about places, about going places. And I find that my eye in your work is traveling through your work. It's like taking a journey. And so in my mind, my eye is following and tracing different pathways and noticing different things. Chinese landscapes are like that, old Chinese landscapes, that they drew them so that you actually traveled through them in your eye and there were little places for you to take a rest. And your work is like that. I'm fascinated by it. This is work that really celebrates the freedom to explore.
Well, thank you very much. I think, unfortunately, it all happened because I was a little boy in the little country, and you just couldn't travel freely, or you wouldn't feel that you are in the big country or living on the seashore. I was in the landlocked country, and I sort of, this was my way of expressing like some desire to travel or become an explorer, become adventurer. And I think it was a reflection of the time, and now I think people just push some button and can see pictures of beautiful mountains and seas, and they think this is what the world looks like. But I think it was my desire to travel and to dream and to be able to forget about the world and just open the page, because that was all we had as kids, and just would be lost.
You know, a lot of people forget what it's like before the internet. For people who were in a situation like yourself, you grew up in Czechoslovakia,
right?
And you went through the Prague Spring, but you also went through the other parts, and people had no concept of what that means for people's imaginations.
Now, that's so interesting to speak to young people today, because they do not comprehend. I mean, they would say, like, if they build a wall, obviously must be some place you can go around that wall. And they say, no, there was no place to go around that wall. And they just do not understand. Even my daughter would say, well, if you didn't like it, why wouldn't you walk away? And it's just that whole concept, you can't walk away. And the same thing with music, that in our time, it was all hearsay. And then at certain time at night, if you would be lucky enough to have a little transistor radio and hold it in the air in your hands, you would be able to get these sounds from Radio Luxembourg, which was in Luxembourg.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it was this jam music, so everything would be heard from the Kinks or from the Searchers or from the Beatles.
Oh, man. I think we're close in age, because Needles and Pins by the Searchers still makes me send chills up my spine. But I can't imagine what it would be like to grow up like that. And there, you drew and wrote an amazing book about growing up behind the Iron Curtain. It was in 2007. And right, just the act of putting stuff on a wall was subversive.
Yeah, it was, well, in the way, you know, now they build new walls everywhere around the world. And I think still people, if they live in the neat community and some kids would come and spray the wall, they say, no, this is doesn't look good. But here was like some fear of the political statement. It was the same with rock music. I think the communist system in Czechoslovakia and all of Eastern Europe would be somehow, they tolerated jazz music just because after the Second World War, it was banned by the Germans, and the jazz was expression also of working class in America, and African-American musicians would be in the struggle against the ruling class. So jazz was sort of tolerated, but when came the beat music with the hair and with all the sort of show of the outside culture, and the same thing applied to painting on the wall or behaving in some way that you were antisocial. So most amazing thing about the Lennon wall was that some young people painted portrait of John Lennon when he was shot in 1980, and then other people came and painted all these symbols based on love and Beatles songs, but then government realized they have no control, so they send the police to paint over it with some gray colors, upon which kids met the night and painted it again, and it became this whole struggle of painting and police waiting to beat up the people who would paint on the wall.
Jesus.
Funny thing was that, the government, because it was already the advanced stage of communism just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, was that they established a committee of people who can officially paint on the wall, who were like sort of approved.
So
official people and unofficial people. And of course, now Prague becoming such a tourist attraction, the wall was not on the main route. But now if you come to Prague, you have somebody standing there with the guitar playing Beatles songs and tourist buses coming with mostly Chinese tourists, which is now funny, and they are looking at it as a tourist attraction, and people paint on the wall as they wish.
Now, did I read this correctly, that during the Prague Spring, you formed a band and you were a DJ yourself?
So I was...
I need to know about your band.
My band was terrible. But my band was a DJ band, because what I realized is like, I was a singer because there was nobody else, and I didn't play really well on the guitar. But we selected songs from many different groups, if it was Pretty Things and Kings and Rolling Stones. Like one song of each, because then I would always announce the group and say, well, this group lives in England, there are five members in this. So it was like a discotheque, really, and that people held it against me because we didn't have really particular style, because we played all these different songs. And after that, I got, thanks to my father, some records, and I became one of the first and most famous DJs in the radio show.
Oh, man.
Through 1969, and then, of course, it got banned because it played bad Western capitalist music, and it was over.
Did you play Jimi Hendrix?
I played Jimi Hendrix. And I remember how I was dreaming about Woodstock in 69.
Oh,
When I heard somewhere far away all these peace-loving people and people who are... I mean, this is, I think, partially why I came to America, because it was like, there's a country when everybody's like these people from Woodstock, and they all listen to Jimi Hendrix and love flowers and peace. It was part of this whole sort of enigma of America for me.
Now, your father was a really important person to you and an inspiration. Can you talk about your father for a bit?
So my father was important also in, like, most of all, because he would always wake us up in the morning with my sister and said the whole world was already working and he's still sleeping. So even now when we hear a deep voice like you have, we sort of like jump out of bed because we think it's our father. But he was a young filmmaker who was like everybody else drafted to the army, because he was a filmmaker. He was in the army film unit. And at that time, all of Eastern Europe was, of course, like one friendly block of these Eastern European countries, including China. And China asked for two filmmakers who would come to China to teach documentary filmmakers how to establish shot, how to use 35mm camera. So my father, and I didn't understand it because I was like 4 years old, told my mother he would be gone for... No, he would come back for Christmas, but he came for Christmas 2 years later, which he didn't know, and he got to China to teach young filmmakers. And China was building in that time a road to this faraway province, which they claimed they have to bring civilization to, and it was called Tibet.
And your father got sort of marooned in Tibet for a while.
So he was supposed to shoot construction of this road, and they used explosives. I still have a film of it. And then the road collapsed, and he became stranded in Tibet ahead of the construction. And he got to Lhasa and met His Holiness Dalai Lama, who was 18 years old, and who had dark glasses like Elvis and had this beautiful golden sort of outfit. And I think it changed my father forever. He never talked about it, but he made the film, came back, and was, being from such a small country as was Czechoslovakia, he was somebody who got so far, and everybody wanted to hear his story about Tibet, but it wasn't agreeable with the politics again. So I was the beneficiary of it.
Yeah.
He would tell me stories in the evening, and when he was then diagnosed with some terrible disease, I decided I have to make this book, which is dedicated to him, called Tibet Through the Red Box.
And it's a beautiful book that the color red has a lot of meaning in this book.
A lot of meaning, yes. Which also in the wall, the red had also meaning, and it's the same like also in the book of, it's like the red can mean some beautiful things and can also mean some awful things. So red here was this whole indoctrination which was coming to Tibet, and according to his diaries, he met these very nice, almost children, like, no, I shouldn't say that, but they were like sort of very nice people who didn't really even know what's coming to them. Oh, and I have to say, when I did the book, like in 1998, I was so much hoping that by 2000 there would be some sort of agreement between China and Tibet about the Dalai Lama didn't even want the independence, like just the autonomy for Tibet and the language and the schools and the whole history, and it didn't happen, and it's still a terrible disaster, and I just feel for the Tibetan people now so much.
Me too. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Peter Cease, a Czech-born American illustrator, artist, author of children's books. He's animated. An exhibition of his work called The Picture Book Odysseys of Peter Cease is at the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art here in Amherst until October 27th. Peter, you studied at while in Czechoslovakia at the Academy of Applied Arts in Prague. And the reason I ask you about that, because it says that you ended up studying with Jiří Trnka.
So Jiří Trnka.
I know that. I love his work.
Oh, wonderful. Because, again, like with the wall, which is sort of fortunate people don't remember, he was such a great artist and especially a filmmaker with his puppets. But again, hard to find any traces today. But he selected me as his student because he just became professor in 1968. And unfortunately, he only lived 1 year after that. But still, I had a chance to talk to him. And I said, I want to do animation. I don't really want to do illustration. And he looked at me and he said, well, I hope you're not sorry one day, which in the way happened with the films, which brought me to America. Then it didn't quite work for me, and I turned to books as the only possible sort of way of paying rent in New York, I guess. But then they became my love and my sort of my little films, because the book, or even better than that, because you don't have to move on in time. You can just stay on one page for as long as you want.
I've taught animation for many years.
And, oh, you did?
Yeah, and I can tell you, it's a lot of painstaking work. However, when I look at your drawings, I think what you're doing in your drawings is just as painstaking as doing animation. You like detail work, and one of your large drawings will take many days for you to finish. What happens to your mind when you're working on a very complicated drawing?
That's a very interesting question, and it's a very interesting question also for if you're born in one country, go to another country, if you can contemplate lots of things, because one thing is when you think about how the book will come together, but then another thing is when you're just executing, you're sort of sitting there for hours listening to music and just sort of going on with the dots or with the, cross-hatching. So that's a very interesting thing, because it's some sort of, like, you get into this whole rhythm, and two people in my life said, you must have been monk before something, because it really is. You look up and you see it's the end of the day. You can't see because your eyes got so fixed on that sort of distance between the paper. But it's a very happy feeling when it's finished because it took so long.
It's like a form of meditation.
It is a form of meditation. And somehow I must be sort of predestined to do that, because when I did animation, I did probably like 3 or 4 films. Each one was like 7 to 9 minutes long. And it took me a year to make a film. Of course, it was the movement of the old style camera and all that, but still I was putting so much detail, and people, there was the same in animation and when I did editorial for a New York Times for 17 years, and people would always say, don't spend so much time, people don't see it like that. When you open paper, you can just take a brush and make a spot and they will see it if I do. But it was somehow my own sort of satisfaction to put all that work in it.
Well, you have such a recognizable and distinctive style now. How long did it take you to feel that you finally developed your own style?
It's puzzling because I used to do much freer stuff when I, especially doing storyboards, and some of it is in the exhibition. But when I came to New York and I found out that the apartment, even 35 years ago, something was expensive. I sort of, and people said, "Oh, you can become a waiter, or you can work in the animation studio in the mailroom, maybe because you don't speak English quite well." And I thought, "Okay, so what can I do?" And someone said, "Go to New York Times," and I got work right away. But I was thinking, I have to have some style so people know this, and that way I can be sure I will get picture to do every week. And I came up with this idea of making little dots, which was an excellent idea because I was different from everybody else.
Right.
But the trouble was that it took me like 2 days to make a picture, which anybody else would do in 10 minutes. So my social life was non-existent because I was always sitting at home making dots. And I became all dotty myself. And then people would call me. That was the power of America. All of a sudden, I started to get these phone calls, and they said, "Oh, we are from Boston Globe, or we are from San Francisco Chronicle. Would you do a picture for us? But we would like to have those dots." And so even my first children's book is made of all of dots, because that became my claim to fame, really.
How was it working on deadlines? Because people don't understand. And by the way, I can remember all those early drawings for the New York Times book review section and the op-ed page.
Oh, amazing.
Your style is just so distinctive. But people don't realize, they'll give you like, 2 days notice and say, "We need it then?"
Yeah, the New York Times book review would give you New York notice, but there was also op-ed, and there were other sections when they would call me and say, "Can you do it overnight?" But I loved it because it was like, I'm in America. I'm also like, I can't go back home. And all of a sudden I was like wanted, and I was ready for it, and I wouldn't mind that I wouldn't sleep for 3 days. The funny thing with the op-ed was that I really established a relationship with Steve Heller, who was the art director, and sometimes it wouldn't work. Sometimes I did something, because the thing was that what I didn't know for the longest time, the concept of book review was that you have a book which is like a famous book, and then you give it to the famous person to review it.
Right.
And I couldn't even speak English, but I was getting constantly like bagel with something else that I wanted because I didn't know how to say it. So I'm reading review by John Updike on the book, I don't know, written by Salman Rushdie or something. And it was lots of poetic language or lots of sort of parallels I didn't know. So I drew pictures which were complete sort of like, if I look at it now, it became a real surrealistic experience because I was illustrating something I had no idea. But somehow it
worked.
It's sort of crazy when I look at it now. Some of the very famous books, which I had no idea who these people are, and then I met them and said, "Oh my God, I did the illustration for Rushdie for Satanic Verses," and who knows if I was in trouble or not.
One of your books, which is several examples are in the exhibition, is one of my favorite books, The Conference of Birds, by the Fridudin Yatar, who's a Persian Sufic. Your work on that is beautiful. It's really stunning. Talk to me about coming up with your own take on a hoopoe. It's just, your hoopoe is beautiful.
The hoopoe was... It was a story which I discovered reading Borges. No, I also doing illustrations for Borges, and Borges mentions it, and I thought, this is fantastic. This is about what it's all about, that people are looking for some meaning, somebody who would give them spiritual sense, which way to go, what to do. And so I made a little dummy, which is in the exhibition too, and I was trying to approach all the publishers I knew, but they would be mostly children book publishers, and they thought, what does he see in it? And I became sort of obsessed with it, and finally got home with Anne Godof at Penguin. But then it was one of those books when you work for adult people, and they say, "Oh, well, now you go and do whatever you want to do." And you say, "Well, how many pages, how many illustrations?" Because I got so used to sort of somebody telling me what dimensions. And they said, no, just do what you think is right. So then I had about 100-something pages, and I thought I should better finish. And my wife was thinking, like, "Don't you think you should better get it out of the house?" But the book was also... interesting in the way that it lets, like, lots of books lead to other things that exactly the hoopoe is such so strange, because he tells the birds, I will show you the way, I will tell you where we find this magic bird called Seymour,
right,
who will lead us. And I thought it's so fitting to Václav Havel in Prague, who was like this hoopoe for people say, I know which way to go. So actually I had a chance when the book came out to give it to him as a present.
Wow. Which
was just a few months before he passed.
Oh, wow.
And but then when he passed, they said, would you do a cover for the magazine, which would be like a tribute to him? And I made a man made out of birds who's flying over Prague. It was sort of inspiration when you see like a flock of pigeons or something, and in the sunset they have the reflection of the sun. And I thought it was like with Havel, who was such a hope and sort of
futuristic person.
And they made it into... They said, oh, this is a beautiful picture. We will get tapestry weaved in Aubusson, France. And they made this huge tapestry, which is now in Prague Airport. And it's a sort of dedication. It was done for the Arts for Amnesty International.
Fantastic.
As a gift. And people like you two and Peter Gabriel and Yoko Ono sort of put up the money to have it woven. And then it's forever the gift to the airport of Václav Havel in Prague, which is so cool.
See, the rock pays off. The rock music pays off.
It comes back. The rock comes back. The only problem is I meet somebody and then I go, like, didn't we meet in Marquee in 1969? But we can hardly recognize each other now. I go, yeah, I remember you.
In one of your paintings about growing up behind the Iron Curtain, it's about the Prague Spring, where it's really amazing. All of a sudden, color and all sorts of wild stuff happens, and it looks like the animation to Yellow Submarine.
Yes, that's
right. And the Yellow Submarine is in there.
No, you are amazing, because you like understand everything I tried to do, and I was like losing hope in America because nobody could follow me, and you understand everything with animation and Yellow Submarine.
Oh man.
And when Edelman was my hero, and I wanted to express somehow how Prague became free, and that was started with the visit of Allen Ginsberg in 65, and then Harlem Globetrotters came and everybody thought, this is amazing. They have like uniforms made of American flag with stars and stripes, and look how they play basketball. They are so tall. And then there was that sort of culminated with the visit of the Beach Boys. And then I was a DJ already, and they said, would you become the announcer of the concert of the Beach Boys? So I was like going around Czechoslovakia with the Beach Boys. They had a private plane.
Wow.
And
wow.
I would go on the stage and go, ladies and gentlemen, here they are from California, the Beach Boys.
Oh, man.
And I became most like friendly with Al Jardine, but with the drummer. And he, in that time, what I couldn't have known, in his house was this, Manson was living in his house in the time he visits Czechoslovakia. So it's all these stories again coming together. And I have to say, in that time, we thought, Beach Boys, it would be, we would prefer some band like the Stones or something heavier.
Yeah.
They're doing all these harmonies, but only after years I realized that Pet Sounds and everything is so highly considered. And it was amazing, but we didn't quite, as in life, it happens often that you don't really know what you're seeing or hearing, and then you realize that many years later.
Well, in the words of the Rolling Stones, you can't always get what you want.
No, you can't.
Now, you've done so much, but one of the things you've done, which I've really admired, is you've done a lot of factual books about really interesting people like Charles Darwin, and they're all interesting people who are rebels in their own way. Mozart, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, there's a Czech folk hero too, Jan Zedwelzel.
They all have
some things in common, and a lot of them travel. Or even if they just travel in their mind, you know.
Right.
When I think of Galileo, I think of a man who changed the way we think about the universe. And I love those books. And the funny thing is, for most of your books, you don't need words; the pictures tell the entire story.
Because I couldn't speak English.
but it ends up and works. See, it's like a lot of times things like this is why it becomes special.
No, you are really wonderful to talk to because you understand everything. But it was really because I was picking the people. It was about travel, about the freedom to go where you want to go. And in that time, I was trying to probably get into the frame of mind when I was happy to be in America, but I was also tortured because I didn't go back. And I was that was like one of the biggest no-nos in my country, and they would sentence you to prison just for not coming back. Even if they let people go, they would just go see something and go back. And I was picking the people who had the fortitude and who had the courage to do things nobody else did before, even they would somehow be not so sure how it's going to go. So Galileo was obvious with his whole... I had the picture of Galileo in my book. Even he stands in front of the cardinals. And for me, that was a symbol of like the power over the individual when he has to sort of explain his theory and sort of pull back, because otherwise he would go and he would be burned alive. And with Darwin, it was very interesting because he thinks his whole life really was so hard to draw, because he goes on this incredible tour on Beagle, but then he just sits and thinks and does little experiments. But it was like a most researched book I ever did. And with the man who went to live with the Eskimos, Jan Veltzl, he was so a typical Czech who didn't want to live under Austria-Hungary and be involved in the First World War. And he goes through Russia, and then he lives on Yukon territory and up in the new Siberian islands, and he trades furs, and he's very sort of inventive. So that goes with all these books, and Saint-Exupéry, of course, was my childhood dream about Little Prince. So it's hard to find. If I would tell you now, give me the list of 10 people who are. It's really hard. And sometimes 10 people would say, well, but you, how come you don't have women in it? And believe me, I was trying to get, I wanted to do Madame Curie, but it's all a beautiful book. Then it was Maria Mitchell from Vassar. So I'm trying to find more heroes, but I'm also getting old. So when you do books about real people, you have to do incredible research.
Oh, I know.
There's always somebody who says, he didn't look like this, he didn't have shoes like
that. Yeah, okay. We're completely out of time, Peter, and I feel like we could talk for hours. My guest tonight has been Peter Cease, a Czech-born American illustrator, artist, author, children's book author, and illustrator. He used to have a band, and he was a DJ once, which counts for something. And an exhibition of his work, The Picture Book Odysseys of Peter Cease, is at the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art until October 27th. Peter, it's really been special talking to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.